even if you play in an ordinary team, millions of people will know you. It's the same with the coaches. They also have their own fans. The domain of the support reaches the people who are on the sidelines of football as well. Anyone who's involved with the green rectangle will one way or another become famous and popular. In the middle of all of this, there's an exception. The referees. They are not popular. Their professional activity is not attractive to fans, and they never become a star. For fans, referees are as important as the security forces on the sidelines of the field or the supervisors of matches. Let's think about it right now. How many players do we know? On the other hand, how many referees do we know by their names or appearance? This is why referees shoulder one of the biggest responsibilities of football games. The story is usually like this. The referee is the least known person among the people who run on the field. They get the least amount of money, and they give flack more than everyone else. Everyone expects them to be flawless and restore calm in a match just like a skilled orchestra conductor. The pressure on the judge reveals itself in the World Cup more than any other time. A world of responsibility is hidden behind the whistle blown in the World Cup. The referees are the most important neglected part of the World Cup. January 30th, 1930, when Uruguay faced Argentina in the final match of the first World Cup, officiating a match had no resemblance to what we see today. John Langanis, who was the referee who had put on a coat on his sports shorts, he's even worn a tie. Ulysses Saucedo, the assistant referee, had coached Bolivia at the earlier stage. The biggest problem for the referees was all the teams had brought their own footballs and they wanted to play with their footballs. In fact, officiating a football match gradually morphed into what we know today. Until the 1970 World Cup, the referees would go without yellow or red cards or send the players off.
Trocha goes first. The captain sent off a kicking Emmerich.
Or until the 1994 World Cup. They could only wear black shirts. And until recent World Cups, there were no fourth referees. Besides all of this, the laws to officiate a match were different. Until the 1990 World Cup, the goalkeepers were allowed to handle the ball passed to them by a teammate, or until the 1998 World Cup, diving or faking injuries by players wouldn't get a yellow card. But something hasn't changed compared to those days. The referees still undergo the most intense pressure. No one is optimistic about the referees. The players, coaches, the media, fans, officials with the FIFA Referees Committee, or even politicians. So, in recent years, FIFA has paid special attention to World Cup referees. Nowadays, referee teams are supervised well ahead of the games. They take various tests in several stages. They take part in preparation camps and get to know the latest technologies. FIFA tries to choose the best referees on the planet, men or women with green characters, greater than off-the-field issues and the usual pressure of the World Cup.
I want to thank you, and I want to congratulate you that you have been chosen now for this 2014 journey. You will be my team, you will be FIFA's president's team number 33 in the World Cup. And this is a very important one.
Officiating a match today is easier than the days Lagunas was running after the sun-scorched Argentine players at Estadi Centenari. The special spray, telecommunication technology, the technology to decide whether the ball has passed the goal line, and who knows, maybe even video check. But this isn't the end of the concerns. It only takes a mistake or a suspicious decision on part of a referee to make a mess, especially in an international event that's tied with national pride and patriotism for many people. The fate of all World Cup games are tied to the controversial decisions by the referees. If those decisions hadn't been made, history would have been different.
Charlton and his fellow sharpshooters came back time after time in the Ramsey spirit, believing that with sustained attack, the goals must come. Then Jeff Hurst, cool and collected, had the ball in the net. It bounced out.
Maybe the strong shot by Jeff Hurst in that hard final match was the hardest decision to make in the history of refereeing a match. No one was sure if the ball had entered the goal. No one knows even now. Tofikh Bahramov, the Russian lineman's decision was in favor of the host, Britain. He decided that the ball passed the line.
And the linesmen say yes. Yes.
It was the 101st minute. The Wembley Stadium burst into cheer, and Britain was on the verge of achieving its biggest honor. It wasn't his first mistake in the World Cup. A little earlier in the quarterfinals, Britain played against Argentina.
Now England and Argentina.
In the 35th minute, the referee sent Argentine player Antonio Ratin off. He said Ratin had used swear words. However, Ratin was speaking in Spanish and Rudolf Kraetlin didn't know that language. Ratin refused to get out for 8 minutes. The Argentine players threatened that if the referees did not go back on their decision, they would get off the field. But the referee had made his decision.
Shh.
Argentina had to play with 10 men against the hosts, Britain, and lost the match. In that World Cup, when Uruguay faced West Germany in Sunderland's Roker Park, Schlendinger, a defender who used to play for AC Milan back then, fisted at a corner kick out of the goal. Everyone saw that scene except for the referee, who didn't believe it was a penalty.
And there's trouble already. There's a fight going on in the middle there. Well, this looks like turning into a real battle.
In the Chile-Italy match in 1962, the British referee Ken Aston sent two Italian players off in the first half, while Chilean players were playing rougher than the Italians.
David kicks out regardless of Sanchez's legs, and Lionel Sanchez, son of a boxing champion, knocks out David with a beautiful uppercut.
After the unjustifiable performance by the referee, the fans came up with the idea that FIFA sides with the host countries. The hunch stood out in the 1979 World Cup, when Egyptian Hassan Ali Khandil blew into the whistle and showed the Mexican side off the field, maybe mistakenly. Mario Perez realized that the referee believed that the Mexican side can possess the ball, but El Salvadorian players didn't notice that, and the first goal was scored. The protest was useless. And after that, the 1982 World Cup, with so many strange incidents related to the referees. During the match between Kuwait and France, head of the Kuwaiti Football Federation got into the field and made an objection. He said the fourth goal by the French side should have been dismissed. Fahad stayed on the field for such a long time until Miroslav Stupar was convinced the goal should be disallowed. The French side scored the fourth goal against Kuwait again. It was in the heavyweight semifinal when Harold Schumacher got out of the field and collided with Patrick Battiston. Battiston fainted, but Schumacher didn't even receive a yellow card.
Schumacher clearly makes no attempt to play the ball. He prefers Battiston. The French get no penalty. Schumacher stays on the field. Battiston is carried from it. And France are forced to use their second substitute.
France made a comeback from the 3-1 and got a 3-3 draw and lost the game to Schumacher's skills in the penalty shootouts and were barred from reaching the final. And the dramatic 1986 finals match, when Diego Maradona passed the ball above Peter Shilton with the hand of God.
Is that goal going to be allowed? Schilton came out, Maradona challenged him. Peter Shilton is claiming he was fouled, and that goal is going to be allowed. The ball flicked through by Valdano. He turned it inside, and it was a handball, no question about that. That was the only reason that Maradona was able to rise above the incensed Peter Shilton.
Nasser Ben Ali, the Tunisian referee, allowed the goal, and Maradona ran across the Azteca Stadium to celebrate the goal. Who knows, maybe if the referee had announced that number 10 of Argentina had committed a foul, today the legendary Maradona would have looked differently. And the 1990 World Cup, when in a confrontation between Rijkaard and Rudi Völler, the Dutch player revealed all of his historical hatred by spitting on the German forward's face. And it wasn't a one-off incident. The referee didn't notice that. Later in the game, when Voller crashed into the Dutch goalkeeper, the brawl continued and the judge decided to send both players off. Showed everyone the referee's poor judgment once again in those games. In the evening, when Maradona cried to say the German side did not deserve to walk out as the winners, Voller faked a fall to the ground to gain one of the most controversial penalties in World Cup history. France Beckenbauer's Germany won the nine-man Argentina after a penalty score by Andreas Brehme and became the World Cup champions. In 1998 in France, the biggest right decision in the history of the game was made. During the last minutes of the match between Brazil and Norway, Esfandiar Bahamast showed the penalty spot in favor of Norway. 16 cameras were recording the scene and neither of them showed any foul. Norway hammered the ball home, won the game, and moved on to the next stage. The Moroccan officials believed that everything was set in advance to remove their team from the World Cup, but later on, the images recorded by a Swedish camera showed the referee's masterpiece. He had noticed a foul where no one else did. Now, whenever officiating that match is mentioned, everyone remembers the scene, not the strange dismissal of Laurent Blanc. And we think about South Korea in 2002. Officiating the matches in that edition was in favor of the hosts to the degree that even the most optimistic supervisors got suspicious.
So he's in trouble. In fact, it's a straight red. Off. It's a nine-man Portugal as better.
Two Portuguese players got red cards in the group stage, and South Korea won the match 1-0. And next, their encounter with Italy. South Korean intentionally hit the Italian players, but they weren't sent off. Totti was sent off instead for what the referee thought was a dive while Totti tripped on his feet. The third victims of the wrong judgment were Spain, two goals of whom were disallowed. In that year, Rivaldo faked an injury and the Turkish player received a red card, but the incident was buried under the pile of uproar by the Koreans.
Grosso, and still Grosso, he's done brilliantly, play on, says the referee.
Many people remember the 2006 World Cup with a controversial penalty kick after a foul on Fabio Grosso.
Neil went to ground, Grosso fell over his prostrate body. I think it's more than debatable. It looks a shocker of a decision, to be honest. It's Totti versus Schwarzer.
Many many others, with Josip Simunić's dismissal. In that match, Graham Paul showed three yellow cards to the Croatian player and finally sent him off. The referees in that year were not kind to the Croatian. The 2010 games, it was a repeat of what had happened in Wembley 44 years back, this time around in South Africa. The unstoppable kick by Frank Lampard, the goalpost, the line, and the referee who didn't see it as a goal. It's true, the history of World Cup is replete with goals that were mistakenly disallowed, the players who were mistakenly dismissed, and the fouls that went unnoticed. Who knows what the history of the World Cup would look like without so many mistakes. They are what they are expected to be. Resolute and calm people who make the best decisions in the most sensitive times. The games are fast, attractive, and fair thanks to their intelligence and accuracy. If they make a mistake, even their smallest mistakes can change history. In the outburst of color, light, and sound, in the largest festival in the world, the cameras focus on the superstars. No one notices the referees unless a crisis turns everyone's head to them. We can watch the referees as well. We can watch them do their best to manage the most sensitive scenes of sports. Watching the audacity and courage of a man who runs on a field dotted with mines. This is called football. Watch it carefully.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
Houses exalted by God and desecrated by the godless. In the name of God, the all-merciful, the all-compassionate. Salam, dear listeners, and condolences to you all on a very tragic day. Today is the 13th of the month of Jamadi al-Awwal, the day the most noblest lady of all times achieved martyrdom 75 days after the departure of her illustrious father from the mortal world. Her grief in the brief period that she lived after her father was profound because of the calamities she had suffered at the hands of those who had usurped her inheritance, deprived her husband of his right of political leadership of the Ummah, and smashed the door of her house upon her. She was none other than Hazrat Fatima Zahra, peace upon her, the immaculate daughter of the Almighty's last and greatest messenger, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. Before we present you a special feature on this tragic anniversary of the supreme symbol of all feminine virtues, here is Ayah 36 of Surah Nur of the Noble Quran regarding houses sanctified by God Almighty. In houses Allah has allowed to be exalted, and wherein His name is celebrated, He is glorified therein, morning and evening. The renowned Sunni scholar Tha'labi, in his exegesis of the Noble Quran titled Tafsir al-Kabir, has mentioned on the authority of Anas ibn Malik and Buraida that when asked about the divinely exalted houses, the Prophet said the reference is to the abodes of the prophets. At this, Abu Bakr stood up and asked, O Messenger of God, is the house of Ali and Fatima also among those houses? The Prophet replied, Yes, rather the greater one of those houses. Indeed, this is the gist of undeniable truth. In view of the fact that Ayahs 3 and 4 of Surah Najm state that Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, never speaks of his own desire, and whatever he says is divinely inspired. In other words, the expressions of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, are articles of faith, and any doubt about their meaning, intent, and purport places a big question mark on the faith of the doubter. God knows the fate of the persons also directly heard from the Prophet and yet disobeyed him. History, however, bears testimony that no sooner did the Prophet leave the mortal world, a group of his companions who usurped the caliphate or political rule of the state in order to deprive Imam Ali, peace upon him, of divine right of political leadership, violated the sanctity of the blessed threshold of the Immaculate Fatima, peace upon her. As all authentic books of hadith have mentioned, this group of roadies did not stop at their loud threats and rude rappings of the door where the Prophet used to salute every morning after revelation of Ayah 33 of Surah Ahzab on the pristine purity of the Ahlul Bayt. They blasphemously set fire to the door and smashed it upon Fatima, peace upon her, the paragon of all virtues. The result of this sacrilege was broken ribs and miscarriage for the Prophet's daughter, as the stillborn Mohsen became the first martyr of the Ahlul Bayt, ironically killed by those styling themselves the political heirs of the Prophet. We'll be right back. This is the reason we are clad in black today on the 13th of Jamadi al-Awwal to commemorate the martyrdom of the pride of the Virgin Mary, who following this shocking incident had turned into a faded flower in the prime of youth, walking with the aid of a stick and reciting the heart-rending elegy, O Father, had the calamities that befell me after you were to fall on bright days, they would have turned into dark nights. Several questions arise on the anniversary of this calamity. Why did the regime that had seized power in Medina from those exalted by God desecrate the divinely decreed sanctity of a blessed house? Why did the principal attacker threaten to burn down the whole house along with the four little grandchildren of the Prophet inside it, the boys Imam Hassan and Imam Hussein, and the girls Zainab and Umm Kulthum, peace upon them? Had he and his accomplices not seen the Prophet interrupting his sermon from the pulpit to come down and take his elder grandson in his arms when the boy tipped and fell while entering the Prophet's mosque? Was he not in the row of prostrating worshippers when the Prophet prolonged the prostration before lifting his head only after the toddler Hussein, peace upon him, the younger grandson, had gotten off his back? Didn't this person witness the triumph of Islam over Christianity at the historic field of Mubahale when, as per God's commandment in Ayah 61 of Surah Al Imran, the Prophet took with him for a unique challenge to sift truth from falsehood no one else except his daughter, her two sons and her husband, the impeccable Imam Ali, peace upon him? Moreover, why did these usurpers confiscate Fatima's patrimony of the orchard of Fadak that was given to her by her father in his lifetime as a small compensation for the vast wealth of her mother, Umm al-Mu'minin Khadija, peace upon her, who died penniless after spending all her riches to clothe, feed and shelter the persecuted new Muslims of Mecca? Many more questions flash across our minds when we recall this first ever act of terrorism in the history of Islam by persons hailed as Salaf or progenitors by today's seditious Salafi Takfiri cannibalistic terrorists who masquerade as Muslims to desecrate mosques and shrines, massacre innocent men, women and children, and eat livers and other organs of their human victims. The answer is obvious. Terrorists and traitors have no religion. In pursuit of ulterior political motives, they pay mere lip service to nationalistic tendencies in order to promote a free-willing life of paganism. Since the Prophet's Ahlul Bayt are bulwarks of monotheism and the virtuous way of life, these enemies of humanity assault houses exalted by God. Hazrat Fatima Zahra, peace upon her, thus did not court martyrdom without any cause or for the loss of any earthly possession and worldly status. In fact, the lady whom God hails in the Noble Quran as Kauthar, or a spring of perpetual abundance, endured all these calamities for the sake of God. In defense of the mission of her father, especially the fundamental principle of velayat, or divinely decreed succession to Nubuwwah, for the guidance of human societies that was vested in her husband, Imam Ali, peace upon him, on the day of Qadir, 18th of Dhul-Hajjah, 10 AH, on revelation of Ayah 67 of Surah Ma'idah, she risked her life. The ill-begotten terrorist burst into her house to take Imam Ali, peace upon him, for a forced swearing of allegiance to the coup leaders. But as pointed out by this immaculate lady in her famous sermon in the Prophet's Mosque, they expose themselves as usurpers of the political leadership of the Ahlul Bayt for all time. This is evident by the mass murderers, fornicators, adulterers, drunkards, and the godless who throughout history opposed God-oriented systems through different means, even posing as caliphs. No wonder Hazrat Fatima Zahra, peace upon her, had predicted when she left the mosque after addressing the usurpers as part of her electrifying sermon on the fundamentals of Islam and the facts of the neo-Muslim society that had emerged from centuries of ignorance, idol worship, dirtiness, and all kinds of sins. Now hang to this cheap dromedary of caliphate of yours, and release it not. But beware, the hump of this camel is injured, while there are blisters and holes in its feet. It carries the scars of ignominy and the sign of wrath of Allah. Eternal shame is attached to it.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed, smiling he would say, I am a Muslim. Din al-Islam, din al-Azam, ghayru din Muhammad illi hadini.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God. Welcome to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. Topic that we are going to delve into today or in the upcoming episodes probably is Nazr. And that's what we are going to do according to the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. But before we continue our program, let's take a listen to a short biography. A little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies,
It took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtada Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, "We testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching makasas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up to 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij and his teaching. One can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that.
Back to the program, Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Mohammed Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Tawbid, our guest speaker. We are still talking about the topic of Nazr, according to Ayatollah Khamenei's fatwas. Sheikh Tawbid, you know, one of the ladies asked us this question. Let me put it to you. I set aside some money to visit the holy shrine of Imam Hussein, peace be upon him. What happened is that my husband took this money and added up to his own collection or money and did not return it to me. Considering that I know the amount of this money, is it permissible to take this money from him without his knowledge?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. The money pledged should be spent in its proper place.
Uh-huh.
Okay. And the woman has the right to take a measure to obtain this money, making sure it will not lead to a kind of conflict or dispute between her and her husband. So it should not lead to straining her relationship with her husband. She has the right to take this money from her husband, and if the husband consents to give the money to her without even, you know, resorting to, you know, something to retaliation, then of course she can take it. She can talk to her and tell her. She can talk to him and tell him that, okay, I've made a vow. I want the money back. So the man should give it. The money should give. And in the event that that he does not give it, okay, if the money belonged to the wife, to the woman herself, she can take it out of her husband's pocket. And of course, when it comes to performing the fulfilling the nazar, as I said in one of the previous episodes, I think without doubt, the wife needs her husband's consent and permission, because, you know, if she wants to go to Karbala or to visit the Holy Shrine of Imam Hussein alayhi salatu wasalam, she must get her husband's consent and permission, and it should not be in violation of her duties towards her husband.
Shahjawid, if somebody violates several vows or nazar, what should they do, first of all?
Okay.
Do they have to atone for them?
Yeah, why not? She has to, or he has to atone for the violation. Atonement is the kafara. We use the kafara, okay? Kafara has to be paid by the person who violated the vow. And of course, when it comes to kafara amount, if I can go on,
yes.
Okay, the amount of kafara is very much the same as the amount of oath a person violates. Okay, if a person takes qasam, okay,
mm-hmm.
and says by the name, okay, he says wallahi billahi tallahi, okay, this is a kind of oath, okay, and if a person violates an oath, he has to fulfill the, he has to give a penalty, and he has to atone for it. The same is the case with the vow, with the nazr. If it's violated, it should be compensated, it should be atoned for, and of course the atonement is the same, the atonement.
Mm-hmm.
Unlike, for example, a covenant ahd, you know,
yes
which of course the amount of kafara is different.
I see. Let's take a short break and I'll be back and, in fact, ask you a question quite related to this question. Thank you very much. Let's take a short break. Don't go away.
The followers of Ayatollah Khamenei can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khamenei's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Back to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Mohammad Jawad, hosting this program, and our guest speaker, Sheikh Javid. The topic, Nazr, or vows. Sheikh Javid, just before the break, you were telling us about the kafara and oath, right?
Yes.
In relation to the violation of any vows. So would you shed some light on the differences between vows, qasam, and covenant, just raised before the break?
Yeah. If a person violates a nazr or a qasam, of course the penalty is to feed 10 poor people. If he cannot feed them, he should give them clothes to wear.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And if he cannot do any of these, he should fast for 3 days. Okay?
For any oath.
For the oath he breaks, or for the nazr he violates.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, but as I said, there is a difference between a covenant and a vow. Okay.
Yes.
A vow is nazr, and a covenant is ahd. Ahd is a kind of a promise, if violated, it should be compensated or atoned for differently. Now, if a person breaks a covenant, he has to fast for 60 days. 60 days,
right.
The same as the kafara of breaking a fast intentionally. Now, if a person breaks a fast intentionally, he has to fast for 60 days in a row, 31 days in a row, of course, or he has to feed 60 poor people. And if he is not able, then he has to, let's say, you know, repent and seek divine forgiveness, okay? Or he should actually set a slave free, you know? But in modern time, of course, setting a slave free is not possible because there's no slave to be freed. So there remains two options. One either has to fast for 60 days or feed 60 poor people. This is the covenant of earth. So mm-hmm. This is the penalty of...
The penalty for earth. Yes. Okay, thank you very much. Let me ask you another question, Sheikh Shobit. Is it obligatory to act strictly according to the vows?
Yes. Of course, if a person makes a vow to perform an act,
yes,
he should perform it in strict accordance with the vow he made. Okay. For example, if he makes a vow to give sadaqah or to fast on the first day of every month on the first day of every lunar month, or to offer prayers on the first of every month, okay, then he should perform. He should act according to the vow. He mm-hmm. cannot postpone the nazar. He cannot delay it. He cannot offer fulfill the nazar one day before the first day of the month or mm-hmm. one day after it, or he yes. cannot do it at the end of the month. So he should go ahead and comply with the nazar according to the vow he made. He cannot breach it, and he should be very much strict and act very much in accordance with the vow he made.
If you have two neighbors who are both poor,
yes,
all right, and if you make a vow to, for example, give one meal of food,
yes,
to one of your neighbors, all right, and if you have made it certain in your vows, but something happens, for example, can you give it to the other poor neighbor, or you have to wait to give it to give the food to the neighbor you had in mind?
Okay, if you had made a vow and you had specified it, okay, and even in your mind that you are gonna give the food to maybe the neighbor on the right side.
Yes.
You have to go ahead. You have to do it. You have to fulfill
only
it.
To the neighbors on the right.
Only to the neighbor on the right, because you have to act in accordance with it. And if you did not specify the poor people, you can give it to any poor people, even if they are your neighbors or if they are somewhere very far away. And even if he does not live in your neighborhood, you can give it to any poor person.
I see. Thank you very much, Sheikh Shobit. Thank you for listening to your program, Islamic Laws, on IRIB English Radio. Please keep us in your du'as. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
رحمن رحيم منان كريم سلام عليم ملجا لا إله إلا هو غفار جميل وهاب لطيف تواب سميع بصير لا إله إلا هو وحيد قدير محيي مميت الظاهر والباطن لا إله إلا هو لا إله إلا هو.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Thank you.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.